copy, shift box.
Okay, radio check.
Yeah, radio's working fine.
Yeah, copy all personnel.
Yeah, copy, mate.
The chair in the Vimberg.
Yeah, stitcher up there, thanks, mate.
Yeah, right, copy that.
Right, g'day, Money Miners. Today we've got MD, Darren Stralo, coming on to give a bit of insight into the quarterly activities report released by Bellevue Gold today. On track and on budget, Stralo's going to go into a bit more depth of what's happening at Bellevue. We've also got 29 Metals releasing an operational update for their flood-stricken Capricorn copper operation. And the lads are going to do a little piece on Yancoal. Not that we're supporting coal, but you'll fall over once you hear the trading multiples that these companies are trading at in compared to the gold producers. This is Money of Mine, 20th of April, Thursday. Trav and JD, gentlemen, 11th episode.
12th, mate.
12th. Jesus Christ. Aren't we having fun too? Thanks for everyone, all the comments and the feedback that's been coming back and all the phone calls. And look, everyone's getting behind it. Sensational. How's your LinkedIn following going, boys?
It's climbing every day, Matty. LinkedIn, it's been a surprise how much that's been the social media of reach.
Yeah, though Trav has quite the specialty on Instagram as well for those followers out there. Check them out.
Very good, very good. Apologies, we're going into the winter season and my voice is rather sexy today, you'd say, with the stock standard virus you get as the temperature changes. So bear with
29 degree winter day, just out in Perth.
still in shorts, right. So let's get into it. Now, Bellevue have released their quarterly activities report, quarterly financial statement today. Look, they're on budget, on track to reach production for their Bellevue Gold project. Very exciting project, very high grade. One of the big, great development success stories in the Aussie mining sector of recent times. So without going into too much detail, Stralo, welcome to Money Mine, mate. This is part of the free promotional stuff I do to you to pay back my underground time departure. It's still ongoing.
No, that's good, mate. And I'm sure it's a good reference back to one of the old Life of Mine podcasts to talk about the time I hired you as a graduate.
that was the start of your career. Just went straight up since then. I think it's all related. It comes back to you. Hey, Darren.
Stralo's career went up after that podcast, actually.
I'm a bit flat, boys, because you know I was the first one to give Matty Michael a job after uni, and you had another managing director on the podcast before me. So, mate, you're supposed to pay those things back, Matty.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. The criticism still keeps coming. It's good to hear. Thanks for taking the time. We appreciate you coming on, and especially knowing that Trav's going to grill you with a good question at the end. So, mate, your quarterly's out today. Everything looks on track, on budget. How's it all tracking out at the exciting new development project in Australia?
Look, mate, the answer is it's busy. Like, there's so much going on at the moment. You know, we're underground mining, we're open pit mining, we're building a plant, and all at the same time. So look, there's plenty of action on site. Everyone is, you know, really busy, really flat out, but it's actually nice to have, you know, production just on the horizon, so everyone knows what they're pulling towards. And you know, despite the busyness and despite all the work that's happening, everyone is really, you know, enjoying themselves and having a good time, or at least that's what they show me when I go to site.
Good stuff. And so when's production on track for at this stage still?
Yeah, so we're guiding towards the second half of this year, and it's going to be more in the middle of that and towards the end of that.
Very good, mate. Now, the infamous hard ground that everyone hears about with Bellevue, how's, I guess, everyone dealing with it, the mentality and how you're thinking it's going to go with the actual production drilling? I know a lot of it's been the jumbo development that's had to deal with it so far, but how's it looking the production will deal with the hard ground?
Yeah, so look, there's no secret that Bellevue's got hard ground, and with hard ground comes, you know, some positives and some negatives, of course. You know, the negatives being, you know, a bit of extra abrasion when you're doing your drilling, but the positives being the good ground conditions and, you know, the brittle nature of that, you know, really strong basalt is that it responds really well to drill and blast. And we're seeing that in our development now is you can actually put a bit extra into it, and you're actually better off putting a bit extra into it, because if you leave any toe behind, you can't rattle it down because it's so hard. So you're actually better off giving it a little bit more of a hit, so a bit higher a powder factor, and then actually making sure that you get your profile out. So we're going to take all those learnings from what we've seen in the horizontal plane into the vertical plane when we get there. And, you know, yes, it's hard and it's slower drilling than, say, a Jundee like you're used to, Matty. So, you know, I'm going to be averaging, you know, those sort of elite 500 meter per month per jumbo sort of rates. But, you know, we're still confident that, you know, we've been doing sort of big capital drives, like lots of turnouts, lots of vent rises, lots of, you know, fiddly things and still averaging over 300 meters per jumbo. So when we've got, you know, multiple production levels open, you know, massive amount of headings everywhere, we're confident we can push that sort of 350 per jumbo sort of rate, which is still pretty decent.
Now that you have hit the ore drives, have you seen a bit of an uptick in that per jumbo development rate? Now there's the smaller drives and probably a lot more of them and a bit more flow happening.
Yeah, 100%. So, you know, that the development drive that we're on has, you know, multiple headings open, so they're able to go between. It's that smaller profile. You know, it's not that much softer. So, you don't sort of get the benefit of that, but all those other things help, you know, short training distances, multiple headings. So you can pull out and just get straight into another drive while your redog's happening. You're not sitting around idle waiting for things to happen. It's, you can really set it up for that productivity.
Awesome. So, Darren, we've seen some analyst reports that say about 60% of the resource ounces are in the mine plan at the moment, and they talk about potential to increase the mill to 1.2 million tonnes per annum without any capex. And those sorts of statements obviously get investors excited in the increasing gold environment. So the question there is, would it be right to infer at the moment that the project is constrained by the dirt going out into the mill from underground, or what sort of work needs to be done to upgrade that mill?
Yeah, so look, it's a really good question, and there's sort of a nuanced answer to it, as there is with most things, is that, you know, we designed a mill and designed the project based on that million tonnes per annum. So, you know, GR Engineering, who are, you know, building the process plant, you know, they're elite at what they do, particularly when it comes to, you know, just a stock standard CIL plant like we've got. Yeah, so look, we're confident that, you know, if we need to push the plant, and, you know, our operating team on that milling side have a track record of, you know, really being able to optimise mills and push throughput. So we're not really worried about that side. What we want to do is make sure that we can, you know, feed it consistently from an underground perspective. You know, what we don't want to do is have, you know, one big quarter, one low quarter, one big quarter, one low quarter, and sawtooth our way through life and, you know, have to sort of stretch to make things up. We want to, you know, get into a stage where we know what this mine can consistently produce so that we can get that quarter on quarter performance. So, you know, we're going to start off, you know, we've got to be able to walk before we can run. So start off with that million tonne per annum run rate, and that's what we've told the market that we'll do, and that's sort of the big measuring point for us. But once we're underground, we're, you know, in production, we've got anywhere between 5 to 8 separate production areas that we can go from. So, you know, Matty, you obviously worked at Jundee a long time. It's a similar sort of vibe to that, where you have lots of different areas that you can go to. You know, I'm confident that we'll be able to optimize that from a mining perspective as well. So, look, it's not a clear answer, but it is certainly a project that is, you know, built to do what it says it's going to do, but then has contingency for growth built into it.
Oh, look, Darren, I appreciate the response there, and also, you know, I give you kudos for trying to butter me up by, you know, telling
Jack Russell's off its leash.
The family engineering firm is elite. So, but I've still got a hard question for you.
Okay, let's do it.
Darren, like, I was looking at the quarterly, and of course there was some commentary there in relation to the PPA with EDL, and you guys have exercised your right to novate that agreement, and you're currently in the process of a PPA tender. You know, I think there's sort of two questions on my mind as part of that. Like, one is, you know, do you expect costs to go up as a result of this tender process? And the second one is there any link between the PPA being agreed and the drawdown of the project finance facility?
Long question on you. You always ask the hard questions, Trav. So thanks for coming through and being on brand. So look, the power station, we obviously had early works agreements with EDL, and those expired. So, you know, but what we do have is a plan. We have equipment and we're building it. But what we're also doing is, we're in quite advanced discussions with other IPPs. And I think, you really should expect to see something sort of firm come out on that shortly. But, the actual process of building the power plant and having power for milk commissioning hasn't been interrupted through this whole thing. It's just that we've had to take over the contract for a short amount of time while we get the replacement IPP in there. As far as the drawdown facility goes, we do talk consistently with Macquarie Bank. We have done one drawdown in December, and with the equity raise that we did at the time, we don't expect another drawdown. We haven't had to do another drawdown yet, but we can do another drawdown without having that final PPA signed. But look, trust me, it's building power stations on our own is not something that we want to do long term. So we're going to get quite a commercial response in doing it. And look, we're going to be no worse off from a financial front than the last PPA that we were looking at. It is still a competitive market out there for that type of project. Yep. And when you've got a project like Bellevue, tier one ESG credentials, long mine life, it is a really attractive project from a power perspective to be involved with.
So those 6 to 8 mining fronts, Strala, that you talk of, how many of them have the green gold in it?
All of them. That's the answer.
Very good. You did. I wasn't getting away without one smart ass question.
No, it's always good to talk about. But what we want to do, and the whole green gold narrative is, there's no companies out there apart from Bellevue that are targeting net zero by 2026. We have a really solid plan of how we're going to do that. By avoiding carbon emissions, reducing the ones that we have on site, engineering ones further out, and then offsetting a tail. This will create a product from Bellevue that doesn't have any carbon attached to it. So,
do you get a high price for that product?
Well, nobody's doing it at the moment, right? There's examples of other commodities and other products that are zero carbon that have a higher price attached to them, but no one's doing it in gold yet because no one's done it. So we're discussing with certain refiners at the moment about a verification process so that you can track where the gold comes from the mine all the way through to the gold bar. And then rather than just be blended with all the other gold bars at the refiner, actually have a Bellevue stamped bar that doesn't have any carbon attached to it, and then try and find a market for it. So it's an exciting opportunity. Nobody else is doing it. And if we can get a premium, then it'll pay for itself. So it's a very big positive for us.
That's very interesting. Yeah. What's the, I will let you go soon, Darren, but I'm just so excited to have you on. But with your haulage underground and like the actual electrical adoption of that sort of stuff, is it going to be a bit of a delay in uptake by everyone? Are you looking into it? I know it's so difficult to predict things at this stage, decline haulage, but
what's your thoughts? 100%. The biggest sort of residual carbon emissions that we have are through diesel use. And at the moment, that is an engineering constraint. And it's one that's going to be hard for particularly underground mines in Western Australia, which are primarily decline mines that use big trucks. Just having the equipment to be able to do that haulage without diesel is going to take a little bit of time. What we've done is we've joined a group called the Electric Mine Consortium, which is a group of, I think, 11 mining companies and about 20 engineering companies who are all, pooling their common knowledge and their common thoughts to try and solve these problems. So, we're going out to OEMs, we're putting RFIs out to businesses to look at things like long duration battery storage, light vehicles, heavy vehicles, both open pit and underground, how we can influence policymakers on trying to promote electrification of mines. And we're sort of one of the newer groups to come into this EMC, but it's something that we're really excited about. It's something that that the people within Bellevue are really excited to get involved with and be a part of those working groups. So look, what can little old Bellevue do is, just a standalone single asset producer, probably not a lot to influence the OEMs, but if we can join other like-minded companies, maybe it's something that we can do. So we're excited to see where that journey takes us.
Oh, I've got heaps more questions, but I think we're just going to have a long-winded one day stretch. So let's chuck that in the planned calendar, I think. There's a lot to into with Bellevue.
Nice one, Matty.
Mate, I'll let you get back to the office. Thanks very much for coming on Money of Mine, mate. Really, really appreciate it.
No, pleasure to be here. I really enjoy what you guys are doing and, yeah, keep up the good work. Thanks, Trev, and thanks, JD.
Thanks.
Cheers, Darren.
Cheers, mate. Have a good one. Oh, there you go. Good on you, Stralo. Thanks very much, mate. Really appreciate him coming on. Good fella. That first time you've met him over the phone, lads?
Yeah, that's right.
First time.
Dude, look at me just name dropping. Hey, if you need a number, just let me know, boys. I'll sort it out for you.
You're opening up doors for us, yeah.
Oh, God. Well, at least you bought it. You're probably thinking, I was thinking some days you'd think, what have we actually bought into here? So every time I deliver on something, I'm fulfilling my value. Righto, boys. 29 Metals, they've released an operational update for their Capricorn Copper Project, one of the many projects that were unfortunately severely affected by the heavy rains in North Queensland. So very once in a 100-year or multiple bloody 100-year event by the sound. So I saw some – check out their announcement, actually. It shows some pictures of where the original creek was and where the flood levels got to at this operation. It's unbelievable, the amount of water there. So, look, lads, what do we think about this? They're obviously on hold for a bit, still till next quarter. They're not getting underground back on going. Big impact on 29 Metals.
Yeah, that's it. So it might be even a little worse in some regard to what you just highlighted there. And, yeah, I'd recommend checking out the photos. They're pretty crazy. 29 Metals has definitely come off a lot worse than Evolution and AIC Mines. They're sort of neighbours in that Mount Isa area. And it's really not a great update. So if you pick apart the Capricorn Copper Project, you look at Esperanza South underground, and that's been hit the hardest. This is the ore body that provides 60% of the ROM feed, and it's not really scheduled to start until the first half of 2024. Wow. And if you flick through the report, you'll actually notice in the footnotes that it says Esperanza South is yet to be finally inspected as it remains inundated. So
completely flooded, I assume that means.
Exactly. Yeah. So that first half of 2024 is really just an estimate of when they can get going there again. So the company did flag that the smaller sort of ore bodies, Mammoth, Greenstone, will have sort of phase starts in the mid-September quarter, so a few months away from now. And they also flagged that the water treatment plant looks like it's a complete loss. So trying to look on the positive side of things for the company, there was no damage to the tailings facility and there was no water discharge either. So this is something that had sort of previously attracted a bit of scrutiny for the company. So it's good to see there's no issues, as flooding can at times have pretty adverse impacts on tailings facilities at mine sites. So
because I think they got, was it 20 inches of rain in 5 days or something, 500
yeah,
mil.
Well over 1,000 mils, so pretty hectic
yeah.
rainfall that we saw there. So, yeah, the weather really impacts the ramp-up story for 29 Metals as a whole. Of course, 29 Metals also has the Golden Grove asset in WA. And if you look at their sort of revenue by asset, that makes up roughly 2/3 or so. And this Capricorn Copper makes up about 1/3 or slightly less than 1/3. So, yeah, the Golden Grove is the flagship asset, but this doesn't help the ramp-up story at all for the company.
I'll just give a bit before you go on, JD, what inundated and flooding an underground mine means. Like, the whole mine is underwater, but that includes all your critical infrastructure, like your substations, your fans, all the electrical components you would anticipate are ruined.
Potentially some equipment too.
Yeah, and there'd be I'm not sure how quick they got out from underground, yeah. But there's possible machinery down there that is like, and once it's been underwater for that long, you can pretty much kiss the electrical components goodbye. So
yeah, and that's the issue.
And then you got to pump it out as well.
Yeah, like, with the equipment that they need, I think it specifically relates to the water treatment plant. There's lead times of 3 to 4 months, so that's really hindering the restart at the operations there.
And they've lost the workshop as well by the sound.
Yeah,
so
all the tools, everything.
Tools, so all the fitters, mechanical personnel, all their tools have been. So it's not just the company, it's the actual workforce that have been affected. And those tools are paid for by the people, not the companies.
Yeah, so it's worth mentioning that the company's obviously been in touch with insurers, and we'll keep an eye on how that plays out and if they do get any cash. So digging into the company a bit further now, this is a company that was floated about 2 years ago. They were floated in 2021, spun out of a private equity group, EMR. And it's been hard to judge how management has really performed. If you read their financial report, they report on a calendar year basis, but last year they pointed to COVID and employee absenteeism and stuff. This year, weather related. So it's been really hard to judge as some of these assets ramp up how the management has actually sort of performed.
Yeah.
Difficult assets, like very difficult assets.
Like, totally. And they're fair excuses. I mean, they're sort of these random events. But you know, your point's well received that it's challenging to actually assess performance amid that sort of environment. And yeah, this company did come from EMR Capital, and private equity listing a company on the ASX. It doesn't happen all that often that you get an IPO of a production asset. The only time it never really happens is when it comes via private equity.
It's one of the biggest IPOs in Aussie history. Correct me if I'm wrong. It was pretty decent size, certainly
mining was pretty substantial. I think my numbers could be wrong here, but I think it was about a $500 million IPO in terms of the actual equity raise component. And of course, I can't remember what proportion that was actually a sell down from EMR to facilitate it all, but it would have been a large portion of it. And just touching on that IPO, I think, you know, private equity, what is private equity strategy when it comes to mining? Private equity, they take a view on both the asset, but they also take a view on commodity cycle. So they look to, you know, acquire assets at the bottom of the cycle and assets that they believe they can turn around. But they're usually pretty smart money. they have a good outlook on what, you know, the performance of their assets are going to be over the life of mine. And if they time their entry point in the commodity cycle well, then they'll look to exit, you know, where they think it's pretty juicy as well. So I just to all investors, whenever you're sort of buying private equities bags, it's, you know, you always just sort of think, what do they know that I don't?
Yeah, another private equity asset which is a bit thought provoking would be the asset being spun out of a Barclays natural resource group, the neighbor to Sandfire in Botswana, which they picked up out of insolvency roughly 10 or so years ago, and they're now looking to sell that. So interesting. So I think there's a great discussion that comes up now with the share price having more than halved for 29 Metals over the past few months of, does this become an M&A target? So we've seen a lot of acquisitions over the past few months on the back of share price weakness. Mincor, Newcrest, Oz, they all had performed quite poorly in terms of share price over the months sort of leading up to the bids coming in. And if you look at 29 Metals, they're planned to produce over 80,000 tonnes of copper equivalent, so a bit over 50,000 tonnes of actual copper in there, once everything's running up and smoothly across the two assets. So that looks pretty attractive. And at an EV of $700 million last time I checked, it would sort of be in keeping what we've seen in regards to these sorts of acquisitions and how they've performed. But then, as sort of Trav touched on, this is an asset that's a company that's spun out of private equity. So EMR still holds 45% of the company. And then you have large institutions, AusSuper, Yara, AusBuild, Perpetual. They're all holding between 5 and 8% stakes in the company. And the IPO was done at $2 a share. They're now trading below $1.20. So you kind of think, what sort of premium would be needed? Would EMR block any sort of transaction? It's a sort of tough one to think about. There's absolutely no chance that you'd see something like what we saw with Mincor, with the company just making a bid, putting a huge block on the market and just buying up the stock, because you wouldn't get anywhere near the sort of volume you need to take control of the company. So it sort of makes you wonder.
Well, you just look at Golden Grove as an asset, the history of it. I've got most of it. Normandy owned it originally, 1991. Newmont took them out. They then offloaded it to Oxiana. So Oxiana owned it. Pretty sure then it was MMG owned it. Then MMG sold it to EMR Capital, then EMR, it spun out 29 metals. So that mine has just gone through a lot of hands, and it reflects the difficulty of the asset, because now it's deeper, now it's hotter. The ground conditions are challenging. It's very spread out. So to get the dirt out of the hole is a difficult thing. So when you've got challenging assets, like it's hard going. It's not like a shallow mine where you can rip gold out quickly.
Wasn't it a gold mine to start with, Matty?
I know there's gold there. I can't comment on that.
Normandy. So yeah, I think it was a gold mine. They still get some gold out of it. But I reckon its history was originally as a gold mine.
I'm producing a lot of zinc now as well.
Yeah, down deep, there's a big zinc ore body like that they're heading towards. But you know, when you're down to 1,400-1,500 meters and going deeper, every 100 meters just gets harder and harder and harder and harder to get it all out and deal with the heat. So yeah, bit of underground insight for you lads. Got it.
Beautiful, mate.
That's what I'm here for, you know. Right. Last story of the day. This is before the big recap. God, then the recap's massive these days. Quarterlies and announcements is bloody off its head, the ComSec register. So Yancoal. Usually don't talk about coal. Coal doesn't get talked about by anyone these days because it's such a little goes against the grain of the whole decarbonisation thing, but it's still putting the lights on for all these cameras, and they are making cash over fists, these coal companies. Trav, give us a bit of insight into Yancoal's quarterly yesterday and the whole market.
Yeah, thanks, Matty. I mean, you know, JD and I were looking at the screens late yesterday, and Yancoal dropped their quarterly aftermarket, and you know, we had a look, and it certainly caught our eye. And we ended up doing a little bit of a deep dive, and this is an obscure stock, right? I mean, it's capped at $7.5 billion, which, you know, that's bigger than Sandfire, that's bigger than Evolution, and yet it's a name that, you know, most of our audience probably actually hasn't heard of before. And that in itself is strange, and I think there's a couple of reasons for that. Mostly because if you look at its share register, you know, three names own about 85% of the float, and they're all Chinese names. You know, one party in particular owns 62.3%. So that only really leaves 15% of the shares in free float, and that's split between the ASX and also the Shanghai Stock Exchange as well.
So, and they're giving out like a 17.5% dividend yield. So
it's massive. I think it's above 20%.
They're booked 60, in 70 cents.
Yeah.
So that 62% shareholder is getting billions in the...
It's a huge dividend yield, and I think that's part of what has caught Jonas and my eye is when you look at the dividend yield that these companies are producing. Yancoal stands out to me mostly because of its trading valuation, though. If you look at this company on an EV to EBITDA basis, and we've talked about EV to EBITDA before, Matty, this is, you know, just the multiple that you can use to benchmark other companies, you know, what multiple of their earnings they trade at, right? And
so it's the popularity measure on the stock market in a simple way, is it, Trav, or no, how would you dumb it down for us?
I wouldn't call it popularity. I mean, there's good reasons why some companies trade at certain multiples and even why some sectors trade at high multiples. You know, for example, in tech, you get really, really high multiples because the earnings is deemed to be super sticky if it's subscription revenue. In mining, it's much lower multiple because that revenue is not forever. There's a mine life associated with it. So,
A lot of investors feel it goes one step further than just looking at a PE, which would be the share price over the profit of the company. It just goes one step sort of further into the actual operating cash flow of the company and really separates that out for shareholders and not incorporating the debt holders within the company.
Yeah, totally. Exactly right.
Thanks, lads.
What I did this morning is I charted up how does Yancoal and also the other major coal producers on the ASX, like what sort of multiple do they trade at, and compare it to some battery metals names. And I've also chucked BHP in that chart as well. Viewers on YouTube will be able to see this. And Yancoal trades at 0.9 times its forward-looking next 12-month EBITDA. And that is genuinely crazy to me. I just rarely ever see a company trade at 0.9 times forward-looking EBITDA. And the highest one there is New Hope in the coal section at 2.3. So there's still very, very de minimis multiples. But the really surprising thing there is these companies are printing cash at the moment, like absolutely just printing cash.
So just to hit that point home, the share price of the company more or less equates to 1 year of earnings of the company.
Wow. Literally.
Pretty astounding.
So it was
cause even
it was
by coal standards.
That's Capricorn astounding. Was trading at 9.
It was about 11. Yeah.
11. Yeah. So they're at the other end of the spectrum. But looking at this business, if this was a gold mining company, they would most likely be trading at 11.
No, if it was a gold mining company, it would be between 3 and 5.
Okay.
Yeah. Remember, Capricorn trades at a premium to peers because of what we've previously discussed with the quality of management.
Yeah, totally. Okay. Yeah. I put three battery metals companies there, Lynas, Sandfire and IGO. They trade between, you know, 6 and 12 times. So, I mean, we're talking just genuinely just a crazy difference in multiples. In some cases, they're, you know, an order of magnitude difference.
And for people just listening to the podcast, you can see the other coal names, they're trading at about 2.3, 1.9, 1.1. So the rest of the peers, like Trav said, all around that 5 up to 12 times multiple.
Exactly. And I think at some stage we should really unpack, what has caused the derating in these coal companies. And I mean, we can, in a nutshell, I think there's three reasons. The first is, you know, there's an enormous amount of institutional investors are actually mandated to not own any of them. And then, you know, secondly, a lot of banks are mandated not to be able to debt finance these companies. So the cost of capital goes massively up when that happens. And then thirdly, you know, the consensus outlook on the longevity of coal is in doubt versus the materials that are touted to be really important for the energy transition. I think, you know, then I still look at that 0.9 times EBITDA and think the energy transition is going to happen over a long period of time. It's just the 0.9 times EBITDA is really astounding to me. So I just really wanted to dig into that and what's really going on here. Like, if you take that coal factor away, like, why is this company still trading at such a massive discount? And I think there are two big reasons why. Firstly is that all companies that have a majority, especially Chinese ownership, or even just a majority ownership from a single entity, they will typically trade at a discount because there's just uncertainty with how the dynamics will play out from a concentrated share registry. So there's that element. And the second one is, I don't actually think that investors have full confidence that they'll be the beneficiaries of the cash buildup that's happening at this company. And like, what do I mean by that? Well, if you're a company and you're getting this huge amount of cash in the door, there's basically, as I see it, five things you can do with that cash to actually be using it efficiently. The first one you can be doing is investing in your own growth projects. And in Yancoal's case, their growth projects are pretty de minimis. They don't need a huge amount of CapEx in order to execute them. So like, put a line through that. The second one is M&A, so you can have this inorganic growth. You spend the cash in the door on acquiring other projects. In Yancoal's case, because their share ownership is of these Chinese entities, they'd actually require FIRB approval for any M&A that they were to do. And FIRB has had a complex history of approving things historically, so there'd really be no certainty that FIRB approval would be able to be achieved if they were to do that. So that one's in question to me. The third thing they could do is pay down their debt, and they've actually done that now. All of their debt's paid down. They've got no interest-bearing liabilities anymore. The fourth thing they could do is buy back shares. And when I tuned into their earnings webcast today, management said that buybacks were not on the agenda because their current thinking is that they need to improve liquidity on all their exchanges. So keep in mind, only 15% of this company is free float.
Back.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a challenging, they want to improve liquidity. They see that as the objective, so they're not going to buy back the stock. And the fifth one is dividends. And the dividend policy of this company is to pay the maximum of 50% of their free cash flow after tax or 50% of their net profit after tax, whichever one is higher. So that's 50% to dividends. That's still a lot of cash that you're wondering, how are they going to allocate that efficiently? And so I think what you're seeing there is this company is really cheap purely because the investors just are skeptical that they'll be the real beneficiaries of the cash buildup that this company is going to endure over time. And if I was a shareholder, I'd be really hoping that this company announced the change in its dividend policy or plan to buy back, and that would be a catalyst for a big re-rate, I suspect.
Yeah, I think the buybacks is a real kicker. There are investors out there who still buy coal stocks, and the sort of philosophy they take on how they're going to see a return on that investment is no longer like any other value stock you'd see out there. They're not thinking the market will cotton on sooner or later and that the share price will appreciate. They take the stance that the company will buy back so much of its own stock that the share price will sort of go about increasing that way, and that, you know, sooner or later the company may not even be a public company anymore. But they're not really relying on that traditional appreciation in the share price.
Would that have to be one of the most illiquid stocks that is up around $7 billion market cap, the fact that there's only 15% of shares of the company available for trade to retail?
I can't think of a comparison. I imagine there are other examples on other exchanges, but to my knowledge on the ASX, that'd be up there. Keep in mind, though, it would still be quite liquid because 15% of $7 billion is still a lot of stock.
Yeah, yeah. Right, good on you. That's great, great insight, great little research. And tell you what, now that we're flowing on and we're into episode 12, I feel now, here's a bit of positive feedback. I feel that your research is taken to a new level.
I'm bringing out the Excel charts, Matty. I'm getting back on the tools and liking it.
It's very, very well done, lads. Thanks for making me look extremely good. I appreciate it. Right, recap of the other news. As I said, we've got a bit due to the reporting season. Now, Galena Mining, G1A, they have... they've resumed trading. They're down 33%. So they've raised $20 million and they've reduced their guidance due to ramp up lead grade issues and rainfall delays at their Abra operation. Now, also got Mika Metals, MEK. They've released clay rare earth assays of up to 0.3% for their Circle Valley project down near Esperance. That's a big clay rare earth epicenter in WA that's coming up. Now, I like Mika's announcements. Here's a bit of positive feedback for you, Tim Davidson, because they give a forthcoming announcements timeline for the next 6 months in there and out to tell you what's coming out. So it makes it easy for investors. So they got their initial mineral resource for St. Anne's coming out in April. So that must be getting close, as it is at the end of April. June is the initial mineral resource for the Circle Valley Rare Earths and the PFS for the Murchison Gold Project in June. So keep an eye out for them. Evolution Mining, EVN, they put out some, I guess, extensional drill hole results. Not often you see that exploration results from a big company like that, but they're seeing an expanding footprint at depth for their Ernest Henry sub-level cave. So there's further upside to that PFS for the extension, and these hits are actually below that PFS area in the sub-level cave. So they look like they're hitting about 1,600 metres below the surface, potential to go very deep there. Rio Tinto, they mined 145,000 tonnes of copper for the quarter, and they've dropped their guidance to 590,000 and 640,000 tonnes, previously 650 and 710. And this was due to the impact of conveyor outage at Connecticut together with geotechnical challenges in the Escondida pit. Their iron ore is obviously humming as well. So Mount Catlin, Alchem, they produced 38,900 metric tons of spodumene concentrate. Now that's a 2.3 times increase quarter on quarter, and their recovery was 60%. So significant improvement, because their December quarter recovery was 37% and their September quarter was 25%. So they're at a better area of the ore body now that isn't as fine grained. Now we've seen some buying in AIC Mines, now the fourth largest copper miner on the ASX. So First Sentia, is it that how you pronounce it, JD?
First Sentia.
Oh, I thought, or are you saying they were the first? No, First Sentia have picked up 6.4% of the company, and both the MD and chairman have been buying back the stock this month. So that's always a good indication. Now, Essential Metal shareholders voted on the proposed IGO Tianqi JV takeover today, and Genesis St. Barbara shareholders have given their thoughts on the deal for Genesis buying the Leonora assets. Genesis up 30%, while St Barbara down 15%. Siren Gold, SNG, so they increased their global mineral resource on the South Island of New Zealand to 1.1 million ounces at 3.1 grams per tonne. So Siren Gold, that's run by the ex-ACM founder Brian Roden as the managing director. Now here's a tiny specky one I found to finish it off. Capped at 3.7 million. I found this since I updated my watch list. Moho Resources, they've intersected clay rare earths and up 80% today. There we go. Lads, thank you very much. Great research. And thanks again to Darren Stretchy Stralo for coming on. Really appreciate it, Dazza. Good
thanks,
on you, lads.
Who wrote? Good.
Hooroo. It's not who. Hooroo.
Hooroo.
Oh, there you go.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.